comments made on the Serotalk Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Welcome to the latest Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft. Welcome to Serotalk Tech Chat number 76 for November 4th, 2010. This is Michael Loft, and tonight's topic is PC Security 101. Yes, we're talking about some tips you can use to optimize your safety and maybe even improve speed and performance on your Windows-based computers. That's right, tonight we are strictly staying in the Windows domain because there's certainly enough to cover between Windows 7, Vista, and XP. We'll cover both security software, some optimization software, tools for backing up your data, that's something you like to do, and much more. Got some great guests joining us tonight. Serotech Corporation's Richard Wells, he oversees quality assurance. Thank you for joining us tonight, Richard.
Good to be here.
And also, Peter Bosley, I don't know your exact title over there, he's one of the main guys for the IT department for Ohio State University, so this guy could probably tell us so much about security, it'd scare us, we wouldn't sleep anymore, unplug our computers, but...
That's
good that we just need to be mindful that even though we install security software, that doesn't mean we can just ramble and go anywhere on the web and do anything that we want without some consequences. So before we get started, let's talk about a few shows coming up. Next week, November 11th, we're going to do a Veterans Day tribute. So we'll cover some other things as well. But if you are a veteran or maybe you have done some work with the military and would like to tell your story, we'd like to hear from you. Resources@serotalk.com. November 18th is our holiday online buying guide with useful websites and tips for shopping online to make sure you get your products for the holiday season, how to pay to protect yourself in case the items are damaged or you get the wrong merchandise or it's defective. So whatever the case may be, we'll cover that. 25th falls on Thanksgiving, so we will not have a live event, but we will do something special for you. And I promise it will be special. So we'll pre-record that or maybe do it earlier in the week around the 23rd or so. We'll let you know on that. And December 2nd will be our This Month in Access Tech. And, of course, September 30 will be our This Year in Access Tech. And 2010 is a very interesting year. And as always, your show ideas are welcome. And this show actually tonight came from requests from three different people asking for a show on PC security. So as always, Serotalk, just like Serotech, we do listen to you. With that, I think maybe one of the first questions before we start bouncing around terminology and confusing everyone, I'm going to start with you, Pete, to kind of first differentiate some of these terms, differences between actual viruses versus spyware, malware, and rootkits and trojans, and just kind of explain what some of these words mean so as we talk about them, people can make sense, because not all security software handles all types of nasty files.
So there are several different terms that people use for these kinds of things, and a lot of times people will tell you that they're interchangeable, but really, like Michael said, they're not. A virus is generally a piece of software that is introduced onto your machine from any number of sources, and we'll get into those later, that is meant to actually destroy something. So, you know, viruses generally have a destructive payload. They delete your files, or they cause your system to not be bootable anymore, et cetera, et cetera. What falls under the category of malware and spyware type things are more items that will try to do things like steal your personal information. Some of these keyloggers will stay on your machine for as long as you allow them to, and they will start to gather information on what you're doing online or the information you enter. They're especially dangerous in situations where you may shop online or you might go to your bank's website and log in. And there have been cases where malware has been used to compromise people's bank accounts, et cetera, et cetera. So those are the two major categories, malware and viruses.
Then there's something called rootkits, which aren't really detected by most technologies, and they're really not detectable by a lot of software, right? what?
Well, rootkits are generally a form of malware. Generally, they're meant to compromise your system in such a way that either someone can use it to do something remotely, or you know they can again maybe do something like install keyloggers later. Most of the modern antivirus software has started to target rootkits a lot more because they've begun lately to become more widely used.
Definitely. So first, before we talk about some of our preferred paid security options, let's talk about one that is free, and that being Microsoft Security Essentials. For people who just absolutely refuse to pay, or maybe you're working on someone's computer and you want to put something on there to make sure that they have some level of security going forward.
Nobody was more skeptical than I was when I heard that Microsoft was entering the anti-malware and antivirus arena, I guess. Traditionally, Microsoft does not have a great reputation when it comes to security. I'm happy to say that for the most part, Microsoft has done an all right job with this particular product. You can't beat the price. It is free. You must have a genuine validated copy of Windows, and it does require that you run the new validation tools. But from a securities perspective, they've done a pretty good job. There are things that are better out there that are paid products, but not very many. And the Security Essentials is fairly lightweight. It's well integrated with Windows, and as an IT organization, OSU is actually deployed in parts of the university the enterprise version of Microsoft Security Essentials, and it seems to be working fairly well. I know Richard probably has some comments on that.
Yeah, Microsoft Security Essentials is a good product. Matter of fact, it's the least, and I've done actually some virtual machine benchmark testing, and it's definitely the fastest of the big four, being Komodo, AVG, Avast, and Microsoft Security Essentials. It's definitely the fastest. It doesn't slow down your PC as much as any of the of those others that I mentioned, and it's definitely, you know, I've not gotten anything any kind of. Gotten into any kind of situation that it didn't, that it wasn't able to catch and fix. And I was reading an article recently. It did actually win one of those five star rating awards that a non biased anti malware. And by the way, Microsoft Security Essentials and Viper are both. They're both anti-virus and anti-malware, so they take care of both sides of it. Where something like Avast or AVG doesn't, while it may watch for viruses, they don't watch as much for malware. If you use something like that, you're going to need to use other spyware tools.
Okay, well, let's go to the paid solution that a lot of people seem to prefer, and we can talk about any others you like as well. But that being Viper, formerly Sunbelt Software, I think the company's now called GFI, I do believe. But it seems to be the first choice for a lot of techies. So I'll start with you, Pete, and then Richard. Why do you like this particular package?
Well, Viper has a, for the most part, very good track record of having excellent protection. Their software is widely deployed in enterprise environments, and enterprises have to worry about security hardcore. So when you see something that's deployed heavily in an enterprise, generally speaking, it's a pretty decent product. My first introduction was when they made a pitch to my employer on possibly using their enterprise antivirus program in our university, but for various different reasons, mostly having to do with current relationships with vendors, we didn't end up going that direction. However, after I tried it, I started using it on all of my personal machines. It's lightweight, like Microsoft Security Essentials. It doesn't slow your machine down much, and from an accessibility perspective, it's fairly usable. So all those things put together kind of clinched it for me.
Now, before I go to Richard, let me ask you, because there is a standard Viper and then there's a Viper Premium, which has a firewall. So my question is, do you think that a software firewall is necessary, especially if you have a router or is it necessary if you're one of those who connects your cable or DSL modem directly to your computer without having any router with its own hardware firewall?
I don't think a software firewall is optional ever. Folks, there are ways past the consumer grade hardware firewalls out there. And having a firewall on your computer itself is going to provide you a second level of protection. Envision this. So you're behind a hardware firewall that may be provided by your ISP, or, you know, you may have bought a router, and those are fairly good. But you know, say someone comes over to your house, they're a friend of yours, and they say, hey, let me on your wireless network. So you give them your passcode. Hopefully you have a passcode on your wireless router, and they log into your wireless router. Well, they're on the same network as you now, and they're behind the firewall with you. And if that person happens to have a virus and it happens to be spreading over the network, boom, your machine's infected. I would strongly advise against connecting your machine directly to the internet at any time. If you can avoid that, you know, even if it's a $25 cheap router you buy off of eBay, get a hardware firewall.
Okay, Richard, any comments specifically about Viper before we move on here?
Well, while we're on the subject of hardware versus software firewalls, it's better to have both, as Pete said, and because if somebody does get on your special, there are specific Trojans that will, unless you have some serious port blocking, they will infect all of your machines. They'll go through your network, and they'll go right through your subnet and just get everything. And so it's good to have port blocking both at the hardware and the software level. Viper is by far my choice if I'm going to buy something, and you can't beat the price. I mean, their site licenses for the regular Viper, which is just the plain old Viper without the firewall, it's like $49.95 a year, and I mean, it's like you could put it on what, 8 machines or something like that. It's just it's just by far it blows away any of the others, even Essent Security, not 32, it blows it away price wise. Not 32 is small, light, and fast, but it's also twice the price or better. I'll give you an example of what Viper has done for me and what Viper support has done for me. They went through a period last year where they weren't able to. They weren't able to update some machines for some reason, and people were having to get their updates manual. Anyway, while I was between manual updates, I actually got a Trojan, a rootkit. It was a rootkit virus, and what it was doing is opening up 20 or 30 hidden browser windows. They weren't showing on the screen, and the only way I even knew they were there is because I use open and close program events to tell when stuff is opening and closing on my machine. I heard them. And I called Viper support. They got on my machine. They spent 2 hours, and they completely fixed it. So not only is the software good, but also their support is just bar none. It's the best out there.
Well, good deal. Speaking of routers, Peter, this is two questions, but the first one being, what do you advise people do when getting a new router and setting it up? I mean, by default, they're open. Anybody can walk up and use the internet or, the default password that all of them have based on the make and model. So what do you advise people do? Basic security to make sure your router is a little more protected from letting any neighbor come by and use your internet or do things they shouldn't, which you are liable for.
So, Michael, that's a good point. So understand that, folks, not only security implications for your computers having an open wireless network, but if someone were to pull in your driveway and get on your wireless network and send a threatening note to, say, the President of the United States, the Secret Service is going to be knocking on your door, and you are going to be having to explain yourself. So anything that happens through your internet connection can be tied back to you by what's called an internet protocol address. And, so beyond your own safety, beyond security, understand that there are further problems down the road for that. At minimum, on a wireless router, you want to enable the encryption, and you want to use what's called Wi-Fi protected access, and you'll see that as WPA personal or WPA 2 personal. You can ignore the enterprise entries on there because they don't really apply to most consumer routers, but those two algorithms are the ones that you want to use. Do not use the WEP wireless equivalent protection. That algorithm is old, and the only reason routers include it is because there are a few wireless cards out there that don't support anything higher than that. But understand that that WEP protocol has been cracked. I can sit in someone's driveway and crack their web key in two to three minutes. And it's funny, you can demo this stuff. I occasionally have people that don't believe me, and I demo cracking their key and giving them their passphrase, and it freaks them out.
Now, what about public Wi-Fi networks? I know Windows 7 has an option when you bring it up that asks what type of network you'll be using, whether it's a home or if it's going to be something for work purposes where you're sharing a network, or if you're going to be using a lot of public hotspots. But what do you advise people when they're out in the mix?
So, folks, when you sign on to a public Wi-Fi network that's generally unsecured, you want to select public network when Windows asks you, and what that does is it tells the Windows integrated firewall that you're on a public network, and that instructs the firewall to be pretty locked down.
Oh yeah.
Over the past 2 weeks, there's been a lot of news floating around about unsecure wireless networks, and I don't know how many people have seen this, but there's a Firefox plugin now called FireSheep, and what this Firefox plugin does is when you're on an unsecure wireless networks, you can actually hijack the HTTP sessions of people around you by going through a security loophole that affects a lot of websites. So if you're at Starbucks and you're on the Starbucks Wi-Fi network and you're browsing there and you get on your Amazon account or your Facebook account, there's a lot of sites that are vulnerable with this, but off the top of my head, it's Facebook, Twitter, Amazon. Amazon's the scary one for me, honestly. I can just click on your name on my little FireSheep plugin if I'm sitting there at the same time as you, and I'm on your account because I've stolen your cookie right out of the air.
And email as well, right? A lot of these third-party email, web-based email services aren't encrypting the data, so they can get your...
Some of them, most of the big ones actually have started to use HTTPS for the whole session. Gmail last January, I believe, turned on HTTPS for everyone by default. So at least Gmail has taken the right steps. But Facebook and Amazon and Twitter are three of the major ones that come to mind now, and that's just not good. So in short, stay away from unsecure networks if at all possible. If you can't, then use a VPN service, even if it's a free one. Maybe I'll after the chat here, I'll send Michael some links, and maybe we'll update the show notes with that stuff.
Definitely.
Well, another thing to look at is proxy. And shameless plug here: if you're using SAMNet, you could probably get by better with using a public network like that because you're behind a proxy.
Well, a proxy is not going to protect you from HTTP session hijacking.
True.
FireSheep, yes, that was in this week's newsletter, Windows Secrets, so I do have a link, and I'm going to post that.
What's interesting is that this is not a new problem. Those of us in the security field have been telling websites that they need to start encrypting all of their traffic for a long time, and finally a gentleman got fed up with it and decided to write a program to make it click, 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 easy to hijack someone's HTTP session, just to demonstrate how little it takes to do it. So this is not a new thing. This isn't something that just came up last week. It's been like this forever, folks.
Is there a newer version of Firefox that disables this, or is this all versions?
Nope. You have to have a pretty recent version of Firefox to do it. But it doesn't matter. The person, your target, can be on any browser. I mean, all you need for the plugin is a packet capture, program, and it does the rest for you. The person that you're trying to take over their session doesn't have to be on Firefox. They can be on anything.
Okay, very good point. Pete, I'll start with you, and then Richard. What software, if any, do you recommend for repairing the Windows registry? Because that gets tricky. I've seen a lot of people basically hose their systems doing that, but there's a lot of tools out there. I myself use TuneUp Utilities 2011. Some folks play with CCleaner. There's something called WinPatrol. I don't know how much that does in the registry. That's more for programs that start up with Windows and trying to speed up your system. But what do you recommend, if anything, in that space?
So I don't really recommend too much on the registry side of things because, folks, if your registry is messed up, your system is already in trouble. A lot of these programs have no way of knowing what entries in the registry are really good and really bad. And so They make some educated guesses, which are sometimes right and sometimes not. So it's been my experience that messing around too much with that generally produces some kind of undesired result. That having been said, the one that I've found that probably has never done something bad that I've ever seen is CCleaner. And because and the reason for that is CCleaner takes a very, very, very conservative approach to how they handle registry cleaning. So they tend not to mess too much stuff up. On the other hand, some people complain that they don't fix enough, and that's because they're trying to be careful. So if your registry is really messed up, it's probably time to just reinstall your operating system.
But I mean, what if you install something, you know, before, you know, as you're building a new system and install something early on to prevent corruption in the first place? You still would stay away from these.
Still, I mean, the problem is that the registry cleaners, these registry programs don't really know what kind of changes are good and bad. The registry is kind of this thing where a lot of programs write data to it, and, you know, in order for a registry tool to be really effective, it has to know about every single piece of software out there, which is just not possible.
That's a good point. I'm a big fan of TuneUp Utilities, especially the new 2011 that actually lets you go in and disable an app without physically uninstalling it to see how much it may degrade the performance of your system. But it's a pretty new
software. If you're talking about, you know, just startup programs, then yeah, you know, managing the startup programs in the registry is fairly safe as long as you don't make any permanent changes. But, you know, the same thing can be accomplished in MSConfig. Folks, if you are having startup trouble issues, there's a Microsoft utility in all versions of Windows called MSConfig. And it lets you selectively disable certain startup items. We probably shouldn't get too far into this because it's really complex. And
yeah, we've got links to all these apps if you want to play with them, but you always proceed at your own risk.
And this is kind of a philosophical difference, but I believe in using MSConfig only as a diagnostic tool to disable things as you go through them and you find out, you're trying to find out what's causing your computer not to boot correctly or whatever, and you can enable and disable different things. But the two free ones that I've used are of course CCleaner, and the other one is one called RegScrub, and both of these utilities do pretty well at getting rid of things like orphaned installers. Sometimes even your appwiz.cpl, which is your add remove programs in XP and features in Vista and 7. It won't. These programs, it won't get rid of. Sometimes the uninstaller breaks, and you can get rid of orphaned uninstallers. I had a version of Adobe once that just would not uninstall, and between those two registry tools, I was able to actually remove the orphaned uninstaller, and you know where it would actually where I could actually redo it.
But I've seen problems
there are a lot of uninstall programs that are written poorly and do not remove things gracefully. And my only issue with these registry cleaners and cleaning up after these orphaned installers is, you know, a registry cleaner has to make an educated guess, again, on whether the uninstaller was cleaned up or didn't clean up after itself, or whether the program's just not installed correctly. So, you know, I've seen these registry cleaners say, hey, I'm going to clean up this bad installer data, but the program was actually still installed and just compounded the issue even further. So it's not always a great idea.
And plus, I would be reluctant to use two concurrently. You said CCleaner and RegScrub. I would be a little remiss to use both.
I actually seesaw them, and one will find a group of errors. I blow that away, and I actually prevented a Windows XP reinstall by actually seesawing the two. One found errors, removed those, went to the other one that found errors, removed those, back and forth about four times. Finally, they both got down to zero errors, and the machine was much faster.
And you know, your results may vary on this. You know, I don't like doing this stuff, but I've seen it work a lot, and I've seen it not work sometimes. And so, you know, for me, it's a difference in philosophy. I think I'm a purist, and if I have a system that's messed up bad enough to try to do that, I'm just going to blow it away and reinstall it.
Well, and that also comes into
an environment where you're in the field that you know where you work, it you've got pretty much everything imaged, and you can just, you know, reinstall like nothing. But some of these folks are are having to try to avoid reinstalling as long as possible. And if you're down to a hey, I can't lose, I'm going to try it situation, these registry cleaners can help you recover.
And that's again, it's going to go beyond the scope of this discussion, but certainly also looking at some different software that I played with that actually makes images so you can roll your computer back to an exact date and time. And I've had four different programs I've worked with, everything from Norton Ghost to an older version of Acronis True Image, which is still my favorite, although unfortunately it doesn't work as well with System Access, but that's one of my faves, but there's two new versions, and I don't know if 2011 is accessible. The last version was not. There's one that Brian Cabohan recommends called Casper. So there's some different tools. I played with one recently called Macrium, M-A-C-R-I-U-M, I believe is how that's pronounced. So there are some options if you want to go to that extent, and certainly for people who like to play around and install betas and do a lot of adding and removal of programs, that's something not for the beginner or novice, but intermediate and advanced users might really want to do that if your systems are important, you're using them in a business capacity. So that worst case scenario, even if you, your computer goes into safe mode and without eyesight, you need to reinstall a clean copy of Windows and then install the imaging software and restore the image and bring it back. That's an option for you that has saved me a time or three. But
Wind Patrol. Wind Patrol for just a second. It's a great utility for startup programs, and it's a great utility as you're installing programs. Wind Patrol will tell you that this or that program is getting ready to add something to your startup, and it's a good way to say no. And you might be installing Adobe, but you don't want it to run Adobe Air and Adobe ARM and Adobe Speed Launcher. And if you're running Wind Patrol, it's going to tell you that it's wanting to add this stuff, and you can say no to it, and you'll still have a working program without having to add all this stuff to add it to your startup. So that's a good way to keep your computer running fast.
Yeah, now I don't use it myself, but I do recommend it for a lot of folks because it does prompt them, and if they're conscientious of prompts, that may help them. One of my favorites is that it's going to prompt you that something's changing your file associations. There are certain apps like K1000, some very top-heavy programs that having Wind Patrol running as all these different things are installing could cause you some issues, but it is amazing to learn that you think you're installing one piece of software and there's really six or seven different components being installed there. But for time constraints, Peter, I want to move on and I'll ask your comments, Richard, because I know we've talked about it as well. But your thoughts on something that Microsoft includes, this DEP, this Data Execution Prevention. And I'll just let you comment on it, Pete, and its importance, and so, if you modify it, or what do you do with it?
So, data execution prevention is a feature that was added by Microsoft in Windows XP Service Pack 3. And what this data execution prevention does is helps certain Microsoft applications, like Internet Explorer and some of the Office applications, isolate the memory that these programs use to store data. What that basically does is, as these programs write data to the memory, data execution prevention underneath the hood will randomize the areas of your RAM that these programs use to write to prevent viruses and malware and things like that from exploiting what are known as buffer overflow conditions, which allow these programs to basically trick memory into overrunning and then running whatever bad code they want to run. So data execution prevention has also been included in Windows Vista and Windows 7 and has been enhanced such that it kind of does this function with a lot more things. As for what I do with it, I leave it turned on. Definitely recommend folks to leave that on. If you're getting errors related to data execution prevention, you've got a problem with your computer and you need to track it down instead of just disabling data execution prevention. If that's giving you warnings, that's a warning sign that you've probably somehow caught a virus and it's trying to sneak its way through your system.
Or so. Possibly a pending hard drive failure is what I think I start seeing DEP pop up.
That can happen, but data execution prevention, you're more likely to see that in, if you're having a possible physical memory issues.
Yeah, I would say leave it on as well. But if you do need to run a specific installer that you know is okay and it's not running, one of the options to try is to not turn it off, turn off DEP altogether, but, you know, right-click the executable for that application, go down to Run As, uncheck, the data execution prevention, and see if it will go ahead and install. I have seen that work in a couple of cases, and that only it disables it for that one install.
Yes, we had to do that to, I don't remember what program it was, you and I, that was your
yes.
suggestion. That's how we had to get
but
past
it.
It certainly did. Next question, starting with you, Pete. What changes do you make, if any, to the defaults of Internet Explorer and or Firefox for security?
So, if I had to go through all the changes I make to a default install, it would probably take the rest of the hour. So suffice it to say, personally, I jack up the security settings on even the Internet Zone, and then I take the time to add trusted sites to a trusted site zone and kind of the sites that I use the most, my bank, some of our internal applications, things that I know need to do some of the things that the security settings that I implement block, then I'll add those to that. But generally speaking, I try to crank up the settings a little bit. The reason for that is, and this isn't for everyone, you know, this takes a lot of work. But, you know, the web browser is one of the biggest attack surfaces that you've got these days. One of the easiest ways to sneak in your computer is right through the front door on your web browser, or, you know, something that runs in your web browser, Flash or something like that. So probably a little bit above what most people probably want to do. But personally, that's the approach I take.
I leave it alone. I've never changed anything. And so far, you know, again, except with that one exception, when the Viper wasn't updated all the way, and Pete's right, that's where attacks come in even more often now than email, is you have websites that you visit, and
email's old hat now, folks.
Exactly. I mean, you as a matter of fact, I got to tell you this: my wife was going to some websites just to find some patterns. These are sewing patterns. I mean, this is like, you know, something grandma does. And she went to this one site, and it popped up this thing. You have a virus. If you pay us $39.95, we'll fix it. And every time she went to this one particular site, it was just a spoof of some kind. But it was obvious that the website had been hacked. But they're doing it to everybody. I mean, it's not just BitTorrent sites and stuff like that anymore. It's grandma's patterns. I mean, it's anything, sewing patterns.
Yeah, the email, you don't not to say not to worry about your email attachments, but this doesn't happen as much anymore because the bad guys know that those of us running email systems have locked them down so tight and that we scan everything that comes in and out. They've stopped doing email and they're going for easier pickings.
Like Facebook now, probably, right? Oh yeah, click on this beautiful dog or something.
There are a lot of Facebook viruses. There are a lot of things that claim to be from Facebook that come through email that click on a link and it takes you to a not a Facebook page, but you know, by the time you click the link, it's already too late.
Oh yeah.
Now, by the same token, there are certain types of websites, at least in the past, and like I said, you know, now they're going for mainstream websites as well. But we can, for those who share their computers and let other people, you know, have some separate accounts at the very least, but also be mindful and maybe say no if you know that someone's going to come up and maybe be using porn sites or some of the sites that host torrents.
Gaming sites, BitTorrents, yep. Of course.
Yeah, yep. Free music, some of the gaming.
A lot of the free music sites out there. A lot of the, Flash games out there. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. I would advise people to stay as close to big sites that you know and recognize as possible.
Okay, so well, what pop-up messages? You mentioned the one about, oh, here, we'll scan for virus and make sure that your computer's clean. And it's a trick, and believe me, I've rebuilt systems based on nasty conditions that follow for people who did click on those, who didn't know better. What other types of messages might we see that people need to be immediately thinking about closing out their browser or dealing with?
Well, anything that pops up that claims that you have a virus, if it's not something that you installed, if it's not Viper, if it's not NOD32, if it's not Microsoft Security Essentials, if it comes up in your web browser and says that you've got something, that's a lie. Okay, that they're trying to get you to click on something. They're trying to get you to download their software. I think that they did some research last year, and they said that 60% of the antivirus websites that are on Google are fake. They're not real antivirus programs. So that's a big one. If something pops up and says that you want a free iPad or a free laptop, yeah, that's probably not true either. So, you know, use common sense, folks. If it sounds too good to be true, there's a good chance that it's too good to be true.
Well, that and what else I see, Pete, is people know they're sure it's a scam, but they think, well, I've got antivirus software. I'm just curious. I'm going to go look at this. And we would also say, you know, resist the temptation.
Yeah. Just a quick story for everybody. You know, where I work, we spend tons of time and effort and money on multiple security products to keep our users safe. And we had a user spread a virus around today by clicking on an email that said that she, you know, she was the winner of some foreign lottery. And despite all the security measures we have in place, there's a security vulnerability currently in Adobe Acrobat Reader in all the current versions that has not been patched yet that allows remote code execution. What that means is it allows a hacker to serve up a specially designed PDF file that will introduce code into the system. So she clicked on this PDF file that was supposedly a form to fill out to get her prize, and all of a sudden we have a segment of machines that are infected with a virus. So, you know, and you know, we take this stuff, we take the security seriously, and we've spent a lot of time and effort getting that stuff secure, but you know, your best effort sometimes isn't enough.
Well, that
it's
was
definitely a game of cat and mouse. I mean, the hackers come up with something new, the security companies fix it, you know, and then it's back to the hackers' turn, it's back in their court again, it's cat and mouse all the way.
Well, exactly. Foreign lotteries is another one that is illegal, folks, so you know that can't be happening, so resist the urge there. Sounds too good to be true. Is there any file scanning or security that takes place if we exchange files via Dropbox or even the Amazon EC2? Do these online cloud-based solutions do their own virus scanning?
Not that I'm aware of. There are some places that do scan viruses as you – scan for viruses as you upload to them. But as far as I know, Dropbox doesn't do any filtering, and depending on what you're talking about by EC2, you know.
Right, it's a broad definition. Just if any of the online services do anything like that.
Now, a lot of ISPs do have some, you know, some file scanning that goes through, and some of them won't let, you know, .exe files and .com files and .bat files and things like that go through email. But so, you know, I mean, there's some ISP-based scanning, but I'd be very careful trusting anything cloud, you know, way out there cloud-based, you know, whether it be even the big boys, you know, Amazon or eBay or whoever.
So I think, Pete, you already addressed this, so I'll start with you, Richard. Do you use any kind of imaging software, as we talked about before, like Ghost or anything, to take to roll your machine back to a previous date and time when all was good?
My personal favorite is Norton Ghost, but I haven't used it. I haven't reused it in the last 3 or 4 years, but certainly when I was at FS, you know, that's exactly what we used. We imaged, we would do a testing, whatever testing we did, then we would immediately image the machine again. And Norton Ghost was extremely accessible to really any screen reader, and you know, very easy to use. Pete may want to add some more stuff into the mix, but that Ghost is a great utility.
So I don't really use any imaging tools per se. I've built some automated installers for my operating system. Back when I was using XP on more computers, I had an XP CD that had my installer file, which would automatically install
Windows. Good old answer files, yeah.
Yep, and I added some of the drivers in there with it, so that, you know, my sound would work as soon as the install was finished, and you know, I did that. And also I did the same thing with Windows 7 and Windows Vista. Microsoft has what's called the Automated Installation Kit, which allows you to create an image and create a Windows installation image. These are pretty technically intensive tasks, so probably not something that most people will do. But if you're really dedicated, you can usually muddle your way through it by reading documentation online.
Well, at least those still in the XP realm. probably not much longer, but you know, there's a tool called Nlyte, and you can make an automated CD so that you can put that disk in and hit enter a couple of times, and it basically wipes your C drive and puts a new copy of Windows.
There's Vlyte for Windows 7 now.
Oh, there is a version. Okay. And that you found easier than actually using the, or you have to use in conjunction with that 2 gigabyte automated installation kit.
Yep. You need them both.
Okay. So that's good. That's for the geeks out there who want to play around with that. So what tool do you use? I mean, do you have automated DVDs, or is this a USB drive, or just an external hard drive? Or how do you?
The one that I use at home is just a DVD drive. It's a 9 gigabyte DVD that has some of the drivers for the machines I have preloaded onto it, and that's for Windows 7. The Windows XP was actually just a CD.
And again, some of that's going to depend on how you use your computer, because if you just browse the web and do email, then yeah, maybe just throwing a clean Windows on there and starting from scratch is not a big deal, especially now if you're using cloud or using third-party online email, so all that stuff is backed up, using Gmail or something else, or even SAMNet, where all your material is online. But for those of us who have more specific systems and we have a lot of audio and different software installed, a lot of configurations that could take 4 to 8 hours to rebuild it, I'm a big fan. As Richard said, Ghost is certainly one. I use an older Acronis True Image, and I'm playing around with Macrium and even Casper, although I haven't seen it updated in a while, so I have my concerns about the longevity there. What's going on with the company, I don't know for sure. But so it just depends in part on how you use your computer, if you feel comfortable doing that kind of thing. I'm a big fan of it. I'm a big fan of just backing up the machine every once in a while and then restoring and rolling it back. But that, again, I'm geeky. I take my C drive, and it's nothing but Windows and installed programs, and everything else is stored on another partition. So that's going to be beyond the scope of some folks, but that's just kind of where I am to make sure that everything's going to work. Before we take questions, I'm going to ask, I'll start with you, Pete, any online resources that you recommend for those interested in staying up on security news?
Sunbelt Software, who actually makes Viper, have what's called the Viper Security Newsletter or something like that. I don't know exactly what that is. That's a good one. They're a great resource. And actually all of the major antivirus providers, Norton, although I don't like their product, McAfee, they all have newsletters, and they all have generally pretty all right content, although there's always the slant towards their own software, of course, which is, you know, something that we should all kind of expect. I hate to say this, but you know, you find the security professionals that you know and that you trust, and you follow them on Twitter. I mean, you will probably, Richard and Michael, you follow me on Twitter, and you probably see me complaining about security stuff every once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, every once in a while. So let me ask you, if we're the type to work on other people's computers, make sure you get a chance to answer that previous question, Richard, but what do you recommend? Do you make like a USB stick or something that you know you can walk up, and if that system's laden with viruses or malware, that you can come in and make sure that you're protected, or do you do it with a DVD, or how do you get into that system?
I like read-only media, because a lot of viruses, their first thing to do if somebody plugs a USB drive is to go ahead and infect that drive. So I either do one of two things. I either use a USB drive and I immediately format it when I'm done with it, or I use a CD or a DVD. Speaking of rescue programs, folks, the Viper program offers something called Viper Rescue, which is just command line version of their regular scanning product, and that is a great program. We use it at OSU a lot. If a system is really bad and we need to recover some data off of it, we will boot it into safe mode, which, of course, you know, we had a little discussion on the users forum today. Unfortunately, safe mode is not really accessible, but run Viper Rescue in safe mode. Generally speaking, that gets the system clean enough that we can get on it, back up the files, and then, you know, as Richard said, I'm a hammer on the fly kind of guy. I like to reformat as soon as somebody has a virus, but, you know, at a corporate place, you know, we have our imaging procedures in place, and that's not a big deal.
Well, then you have to worry about replication and passing itself through the network, so it's not an isolated box out there in grandma's kitchen.
One thing I'll say about Viper Rescue is you always want to get the very latest version, and you know, it's like 20 minutes before you go to the person's workstation or house or, you know, wherever you're going to work on that machine, go ahead and download the latest one, the latest rescue tool, and take that with you. That is the number one thing to have in your arsenal is that Viper Rescue utility. And
your other option is you can use a removable if you've got a rewritable CD, you can extract Viper Rescue onto that. And
yes,
if you run Viper on your personal machine, you can just copy the definitions folder off of your hard drive and paste it onto that removable CD, and that will update the definitions. They use the same definitions and everything. So
yep, and that's the first thing to have in your tool. And you know, you might want to bring a couple of the free tune-up utilities, like CCleaner or whatever, if you're dealing with somebody with a new machine. You know, of course, good old PC Decrapifier or things like that.
PC Decrapifier, another one to be careful with. Powerful tool, but in the wrong hands can be a little dangerous, so be careful with that. But a good tool, especially for new boxes. You get a new one with all that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that HP and Toshiba and stuff they throw in there.
Reinstall from scratch.
Yeah. Well, for those who can do it, definitely. That's where you want to go. You know, unless you have one of those. But some folks get those OEM discs with all that crap on there, so they don't have the image.
That's the thing. I mean, every time they reinstall or whatever, I mean, you don't have – a lot of times with OEM stuff, you don't have that option, you know, just reinstalling from scratch.
Well, we're going to have a special segment that you can only get from the show notes, or you can wait. We're going to include it on Monday's podcast. This was done by Richard Wells, showing you some very good tips, thanks to Matt Campbell, about speeding up your computer. Because what happens is when you install things, whether it be Microsoft Security Essentials or Viper, or I'm sure about any of the others, that what happens is by default it's reading your screen reader directories, and of course those are updated quite often, and so you can actually see a slowdown in performance. So we're going to show you how to make sure those directories are excluded so that you don't lose speed and performance, because maybe sometimes what some of us believe is slowdown due to the antivirus software is just because it is conflicting with our screen reading technologies.
Yeah, and the active protection is the biggest slowdown for any software, and your screen reader directories are your least likely places to get a virus. So I'm sure all the hackers out there listening heard that, and they'll say, okay, we'll start on that tomorrow. But those are the least likely places that they would happen, and it really helps folks running AT to exclude those from their active protection.
Well, for those who haven't done so, our last 10 minutes, we'll take any questions from those of you. Again, as always, we prefer text questions just to keep things moving along. We can run a big queue. But if you have any questions for Peter, Richard here in their areas of expertise, by all means, we're talking about PC security, and in this case, particularly Windows. But
while we're on that topic, I'll mention to the Mac users, don't think you're safe because you have a Mac. Last week there was a virus going around Facebook that specifically targeted OS X users, and it was a nasty one to clean up. We had a couple of people, we have some Macs, and we had a couple of people get them. So install antivirus software on your Mac too. There's not as many options for you. You got McAfee. I think Acid has a Mac product. But
Viper or Sunbelt was supposed to, or GFI was supposed to.
Not yet. Right. It's still. It's not out yet, I don't think.
Yeah, because I'd certainly like to know. I mean, I have the Macs here, and I don't know something. I'm just anti-McAfee for whatever reason.
Don't think that you're safe because you have a Mac. I mean, you're safer, but security through obscurity is not the case with Mac OS X anymore. It's not true.
Well, I've said it's a question of when before these folks are going to really target the Mac. They're going to go.
It's now.
It's happening now.
It's true for any freebie, whether it's FreeBSD like the Mac OS or whether it's Linux. I mean, for those of us who run Linux servers, man, you just look at your root mail email every day. You'll see all kinds of hack attempts.
Well, okay. Again, welcoming your questions if you have anything. Did I overlook any important issues? There's so many things that we could certainly go into and cover tonight when you're talking about security. I still say watch the email. You're saying that email's not what it used to be, and certainly not. But some companies' email is still really important. I've seen a number of the PDF attachments, or someone said, you got a bill or an invoice or whatever, and you open that bad boy, and now you're propagating the virus.
And most of your antivirus, Viper and MSE, they're gonna take care of active. They have email scanners, and they'll watch your incoming email, and they'll warn you if you open something bad.
So what do you say to someone who just says, I don't need it because I practice safe computing, so I don't need it? What would you say to someone like that?
There was a virus on Yahoo.com last week. It was in a third-party advertisement. They bought They bought advertisement space on Yahoo.com. So all the major websites have had viruses. They try to keep it quiet because they don't like that to get out. But Yahoo, MSN, I haven't seen any on Google yet, but Google doesn't use any Flash on their pages. So, you know, it's a little bit hard to do that. But Facebook has even been infected. Safe computing is good. Do that. That's important. But it ain't going to save you.
Now, Mike Arrigo points out that there are messages being sent now via Skype claiming that your computer is infected. Have you heard a lot about that, Pete? Do you use Skype in your infrastructure and seeing that?
We don't use Skype in our infrastructure, but any messaging platform, it happens on Facebook, it happens on MSN, it happens on
Twitter even. I mean,
Twitter, it happens on AIM. I haven't seen anyone doing that on Samnet Chat because they probably know if they sent one of those to me, I would probably make a couple of phone calls, and that would be the last message they ever sent. But
and a question here. Got a question here asking, what do you guys think about cross-site scripting and running your browsers in no add-on mode?
Cross-site scripting is another one of those issues that doesn't tend to get a lot of attention, but it is a problem. Unfortunately, the way many web applications work, they kind of rely on being able to use cross-site scripting in certain ways. And so disabling cross-site scripting altogether tends to be a problem. Most of the browsers do an all right job of cross-site scripting or what we call XSS filtering right now. So, you know, that's a problem, but it's not as big a problem as a lot of the third-party add-ons like Flash. Running your browser in no add-on mode, if you can get away with that and it doesn't affect your browsing habits, you know, probably a good idea. But
it does limit you as to what you can do. I mean,
most people find that it doesn't it keeps them from doing things that they want to do. So
let's talk about speed and performance. Those toolbars sure slow things down, at least from my observation.
That's for sure, all toolbars are your enemy. Go through your add remove programs every few days, because every time you install any application, it's going to install one of three things: Bing toolbar, Google toolbar, MSN toolbar, that's four, and a Yahoo toolbar. It's going to install one of those four. So get on there, you know, get in there and remove any toolbars.
When you're installing programs, folks, I notice a lot of people doing this, and I used to be guilty of it myself before things like this started happening.
Just hurry and
don't go next through those windows. Yep. You want to read every window and uncheck those boxes, because most of these programs give you a chance to disable. Like even good software like CCleaner tries to install a toolbar.
There's a couple of them there's a fifth one that the ASK toolbar, ASK toolbar.
Yep.
And they tend to install that one more discreetly without your permission. So watch for that one.
Or advanced options.
Usually there's some kind of way to disable it, and it's usually kind of hard to find it. But most software won't just install it without asking you. I won't say that that'll happen every time, but
I've seen it.
A lot of them now mask it under advanced options, and
Adobe Reader and Flash Player, when you're ready to download those two particular programs, on the download page, there's a checkbox that says, you know, I don't want this, and you have to make sure you check or uncheck that box.
Every single time. Same thing with Java.
Every single time. Yep, same thing with Java.
So is Java necessary, Pete?
There are a lot of websites that do use Java, yeah. I don't know that I'd call it necessary, but a lot of people will find that they can't do stuff without Java.
I make it a practice to install Java on every machine I do.
What about Flash? You talked about Adobe. It sounds like an evil out there, but obviously people wanting to enjoy multimedia almost have to have it, but it poses its own issues.
Like that. You gotta have Flash.
Yep, Flash is another one of those plugins that, you know, I'd like to outlaw, but I can't.
Yep.
Okay, here's a good question. Ranger asks if programs like NetNanny and Windows Live Family Safety actually work. Should we have things like that?
The some of the parental filters out there are better than others, but I wouldn't say that they're 100% and that they're going to work all the time. But if you have children and you want to allow them to have internet access, doing some kind of parental control system is probably a good idea. Although we would hope that you would supervise and talk to your children about their web surfing habits and be able to communicate with them about that.
And the children aren't showing you how to use it.
I would remind parents, and you know, I don't know how many parents there are listening, but I would remind parents, don't give your kid a computer and put it in his room and close the door. That's just asking for, you know, stuff. Keep the computer in the family room if you've got children.
On the security front, I just want to mention one thing real quick because I meant to talk about this a little earlier. If you are really concerned about security, one of the major things you can do to kind of help yourself have a little bit of an edge is use what's called OpenDNS. And if you configure your router to use OpenDNS, OpenDNS will be used on all of your network. And OpenDNS will actively block you from visiting some of the sites that they know have malware and viruses on them. So
They update that daily, too.
Yep. So instead of getting navigated to those websites, you'll get to an OpenDNS page that says, we think this website's not a good page to go to. So
that might be a good link for the show notes, too.
Yep.
Definitely. We've got to include that. OpenDNS is a very, very powerful tool. We're down about 3 minutes, so I want to see if there's any final comments, and I'll start with you, Pete. Any important salient points you want people to walk away from this tech chat?
Just be safe out there. There's a lot of bad guys out there, and you know, I know we sound like a paranoid bunch out here, but you know, we've seen some pretty serious consequences come from some of these attacks, and you know, we want you all to be safe on the internet. We want you to have a good browsing experience and to not run into these problems. But you know, practicing these safety tips will hopefully keep you safe from some of this stuff.
Well, someone writes that emails come without me letting them. Well, I mean, that's email. You either don't use email or you use software where you can start filtering that, or you make conscious choices about whether you even open that message or exactly. If you don't know the recipient. I mean, there's spam out there. Believe me, spam is the number one problem for ISPs you know, even large entities like Ohio State, just universities and corporations, because it eats up a lot of bandwidth. It wastes time that people have to look through those materials. A lot of people use Gmail because of the filtering that they use, although obviously if you use spam filters, then you risk losing messages that you wanted to receive. So there's a trade-off that comes into place there.
I wanted to make one more comment. Oh, go ahead, Pete.
I was just going to mention on the spam front, I was talking to the guy that runs our centralized spam filter, and we get over 5 million spam messages a day.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Mike, the comment that I wanted to make before closing is about routers, wireless again. Pete was talking about WPA as opposed to open or even WEP. And, you know, people will come at you and they'll say, well, I have a note taker. I have this device, that device that only can support WEP. My answer to that is sell it, get it out of your, just get rid of it and use WPA. It's that important. Even out here in the sticks where I live, I've got my network locked down with WPA. It's very important.
Okay, we're getting an echo here, but I think that's a good point to put the ramps on it. Thanks for all of these very, very good suggestions. And I'm going to have to kill Skype here, pot it down so we don't hear that. But I invite you to join us November 11th. We're going to do a tribute to veterans. So if you have a story to tell, by all means, let us know about it. And on November 18th, it's time to talk about online shopping for the holidays. We'll show you some places to find bargains and how to protect yourself by using a credit card, making sure you got the HTTPS, which would be one of my important things. If you're doing any online purchase, go up there and look for the closed padlock or make sure that your URL on your browser begins with HTTPS. But we'll talk about all of that and protecting yourself against defects or non-delivered merchandise or wrong merchandise, all that coming up on November 18th. And we invite you to continue this discussion over in the SAMNet chat room, the tech room, for those of you who are members of SAMNet. If not, you can go over and grab a quick 7-day free trial at www.sa2go.com. So with that, we're going to head out, and we invite you to join us for Monday's November 8th podcast, which will include, you can either get from the show notes or from Monday's podcast, Richard Wells shows us a 13-minute demo of how to speed up your antivirus software by allowing your screen readers, also showing you how to make sure that U3 drive with system access starts up for you right away, even in Windows 7, where you do have to make a change before that happens. So until we meet again next week, let's all stay connected and stay directed. This concludes another Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.